You're listening to the Gunfighter Project, the group that brings you knowledge and experience in order to help prepare you for your worst day by making you formidable and adaptable. Enjoy. Mac Johnson, welcome back for part two on the Gunfighter Project.
Hey, mate. How are you, dude?
Yeah, I'm good. You're using that multilingual language, using mate. I like it.
There you go, man. I'm just trying to build bridges here to distant and foreign lands.
Yeah, that's it. That's how you got to do it. So for the people listening at home, we do have a slight delay between me and Mac, so we're just going to have to deal with it. So Mac, it's I think it's about 4 or 5 months since you were last on the show. So what else has been what's been going on in the meantime?
Oh, a lot. Basically the week after our last conversation, we actually were able to administratively launch a new program I've been working on for about a year and a half. And basically what it is a it's a nonprofit organization that manages advanced research and development, testing and evaluation, and capabilities development support for special operations forces throughout the U.S. The goal with that is to make sure that all of these R&D and capability development efforts that are taking place are happening with the units who are actually going to be delivering those capabilities and focusing on, threat tactics and technologies specific to their area of responsibility. And so this has allowed us to do that. And and so far, it's been very busy, but very fruitful. So that's the latest and greatest with what's happening on my end. Yeah.
So because last time we spoke about kind of your work within R&D and working with the actual guys that are going to be using these items and this equipment to do their job better. So pretty much what your new endeavor focuses on is actually getting it to these guys, getting it in their hands, getting feedback, improving, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and also just working from the standpoint of it's always been, it seems like, where especially for big militaries, where we're kind of behind the curve. We're always trying to play catch up to what the enemy is doing. Obviously technology, combat technology is moving at like an extreme clip right now. We've been getting a lot of and reviewing a lot of AARs, reports from the field in Ukraine and stuff. And the things we see, like these new war finding capabilities, it costs nothing for them to be able to launch a loitering system, a reconnaissance system, to go, and it's going to just pull signal. It's able to identify even the smallest Bluetooth signals and things like that, and it maps that out to a point where it's really easy for people to figure out where military operations, military units are working. And so this soldier signature reduction thing has become extremely important. And so with that, right, this is something that everyone needs to be paying attention to. What, we can't utilize these NIR laser illuminator systems anymore. We can't utilize a lot of the output that we've become accustomed to through the previous wars. So getting people online with that, making sure that these units understand what the threat is and start looking for other technologies or analog systems and are training back to the basics to be able to manage and deal with those threats, or at the very least to just not get killed by them. Right. Like that's should be the baseline. And so we had seen little fragments of that work being done throughout the US and, allied partner nation forces. But I hadn't really seen much as far as that being pulled into a collaborative training environment where they were allowed to just actually like see what the problem is. A lot of times units will go to a training thing and they'll say, okay, we've got drone pilots or whatever, and they're having to basically are they being provided left and right limits of when they can and can't fly, when they can and can't simulate an attack, etc. Because they're like, oh, we want to give a good training experience to the guys that are going. It's like, okay, no, the training experience is that the unit's been hit three times in a row at the entry control point, leaving the forward base. Like the lesson is in there.
Yep.
Like that's the training point. Figure that out. And guys, just especially on the, you know, in the units, you know how it is, man. You got like a very acute window of like your workspace. You're typically afforded the opportunity to go and like solve the problem yourself. And so what we kind of saw was an opportunity to say, hey, I think we can go out and actually start building capabilities, mimicking these environments, and then working with those end user groups who are most focused on those areas of responsibility, and create the capability, create the solution for that, and continually adapt it. And then it also provides us a good way to bring those solutions to the rest of SOF quickly, as quickly as possible. So that everybody's on the same page and everybody understands where we need to be going with this, so that we're not at a standstill if we have to jump into one of these engagements.
So pretty much trying to get ahead of the curve, where you're utilizing or you're recognizing trends in warfare and in the AO of how are things moving away from the rock farmers with an AK, and what are people utilizing now, and how can we get ahead of that before we lose dudes that are overseas in the next conflict.
Exactly. And we have, you know, I've got friends who are in precarious places now, where they're very well inside of this, you know, strike zone where they could be touched by those systems and have been, right? The systems that are being fielded to counter that, like, we've had mixed results on whether they're effective. And now what we've seen is, like in Ukraine, for example, and I'll continue to use this because a lot of this information is public, open source, et cetera.
Yeah.
But it is important and it should be utilized. So, like in Ukraine, we're seeing Russian forces using small drones, spread out by a couple of minutes, on running on different bandwidths.
Yep.
And a lot of them don't even have munitions on them, but they understand that our countermeasures are run by a battery cell in the middle of nowhere, and they're just depleting batteries and then running the assault. Right. So like they're catching on to what our defeat systems, by our, I guess I mean Ukrainian, I'm not going to state one side or the other, but like, I think as far as understanding the countermeasures, they're doing a very good job of that. And adapting their technologies and tactics to be able to defeat those things, and so that they can lay on, you know, strong assaults. And that's one of the big things we've seen lately in Ukraine, is there's been a shift. Russian forces have been pushing through where it's been, you know, basically deadlocked for months, and it's because they're putting a ton of energy into these UAS and loitering munition platforms. And the technology is adapting so quickly that, you know, it's like World War I again, right? Like World War I, we got the machine guns and tanks for the first time ever, and our tactics couldn't compete with the technology. Everybody's in the trenches, and it's the exact same thing now. It just moves too quickly. And guys are just put in a really bad spot currently. So it's, you know, we're going to have to, there's just so much to learn right now. For everybody, and you know, getting out of this mindset of like, okay, we're going to control the airspace, is like, we just will not. Like, I can't imagine a time when we're going to be flying helicopters to an assault, right? It's just like we would have to have some kind of crazy EM technology to buffer and protect that movement. Everything's going back to, you know, old stuff, like Vietnam era LERP stuff. So like that's become a huge focus, and I see that through all the forces. I just got back from Europe, you know, so talking to them, same thing. Everybody's looking at, you know, the 6ARC platform, right? And I work for Noveski, I run their military programs, and that's been something that we've been pushing really hard on, is building out a cartridge on a small frame platform, or building a platform around that 6-arc cartridge that that can be used repeatedly to good effect at the back end of intermediate ranges. We have to have this like longer offset now, and now all militaries are seeing that, and they're like scrambling to figure it out. You know, Russia has fielded 6mm systems, and so now it's like, okay, well, what are we waiting for? We're still trying to like optimize the 5.56 that has twice the wind hold in the same wind as a 6mm Arkwood or a 6 Max or whatever. So that's the, you know, trying to get those technologies and trying to explain that to the acquisition powers and stuff like that. Like sometimes that's difficult, but if we can go in and work with the units themselves and design capabilities that are enabled by those technologies, well, they don't have much of an argument then, right? They say, yeah, no, like this is thing that our tactics are based on us having access to these equipments, these new munitions, etc. So, you know, it's a hard fight, but it's one that I think we're gaining a lot of ground on right now in a short amount of time.
Can you break down this 6-arc conversation topic? Because I think a lot of people listening to this are interested by it, but you're a very smart and articulate dude. Can you break it down for the dummies that are listening like myself about kind of what you guys are focusing on with that?
Yeah, so I'll tell you the backstory with the development of the 6mm arc. So Hornady was approached, and I'm not sure who started the conversation, but a Navy Special Operations unit approached Hornady. Hornady pulled in a team, Proof Research and Nevesky Rifle Works were the companies that got pulled in to work with them on the development of the 6 arc. The in-state desire was to have a small frame capable caliber.
Yep.
Would provide better ballistic, external ballistic, so more efficient in flight, more resilient to atmospherics like wind, and would provide more energy on target and make sure that that could fit inside of a small frame platform. That could be easily carried just like an M4 or whatever, 5.56. And so they took the base cartridge of the 6.5 Grendel, which has been around for a number of years. You know, I've seen them pop up here and there in competition, but it was definitely like a wildcat round, not a very common round. But they took that, necked it down to 6mm, and they've got this cartridge that, it's a fantastic cartridge. If you look at the shape, you know, the shoulder is set pretty far back. It's a wider cartridge at the base, which means that you're getting powder burn all in 360 degrees, you know, in more space versus an elongated case, which typically would provide like a higher standard deviation between rounds because the powder burns a little differently every time. With that, you know, it said, okay, we've got this awesome cartridge. Well, then Nevesky comes in and say, okay, well, we're going to build a combat platform that would best accommodate and optimize this cartridge.
Yeah.
And that Nevesky's always done for since 2001 when John started the company. We've always worked with the end user groups, different, you know, research committees, you know, people want specific guns built. And, you know, Nevesky's not a big shop. The way that we build rifles is a way that not a lot of companies do that because it's very costly and time intensive. We don't cut corners at all. Like if you go to the barrel shop, I mean, it's like, it's serious. Like they take barrel pulling, like that is their thing, right? And so, and it's always match grade barrels, right? So we're running, that's another big difference, is we build 416 R stainless. There's a softer metal, but it translates far better stability to the bullet and better accuracy as a result. You know, with combat guns, what we've seen over the last few years is they've been a big trend towards chrome line cold hammer forged. Are much cheaper, they last really long, but they never have great trajectories, they never have great ballistics because they translate a sloppy bullet into the atmosphere, and so they get pushed around more by wind, etc. So for us, we're always trying to build a match grade system into a combat platform.
Right.
The 6R is a perfect match for that. So, you know, now granted, it wasn't the perfect round, I'll tell you that. So the round geometry of it, it created two main problems that we've seen over the last year or so, which have now been overcome. The first problem being that the bolt face, so a 6.65 Grendel bolt is what you need. So you have to get a different bolt. And because it's wider at the case head, you have a thinner wall around where that bolt face grabs the cartridge. And over time, those pressures and the impact of that bolt slamming back and forth, we were starting to see cracks and shears around those locking lugs on the and so there have been a few things. We've redesigned our bolt and then DLC coded it so that energy isn't displaced into those areas, and that's solved it. We were using a bolt from JP, but I had one shear at, like, I think it was somewhere between 2,800 and 3,000 rounds. And then we switched bolts, and that one's been running great. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing is on feeding, because the shoulder of that cartridge is set so far back, and the bullet sticks out a good ways, and it's a round, like it's a wider cartridge, the bullet does not enter the chamber the same way a 5.56 would. So we can't just run a 5.56 chamber as standard because we're not feeding that same thing into it. So in order to accommodate that, we've got a non-NATO spec chamber geometry that allows for better feeding. And that's why, you know, I think there's three major 6mm arc systems available right now that have been circulated. And ours is definitely the top performer. We've seen all kinds of failures up until this last week. We've seen failures with the other systems, and you know, I've been running the brakes off of mine, and we've gone through a lot of test and evaluation on that. And so it's now become a platform that, like, if I had to go into a combat scenario, like, that's the platform I would take.
Yep.
No doubt about it. And just seeing, like, it's literally half the wind hold as a 77 grain OTM, and way more energy on target. So, and that's important right now because we're not just making noise, right? We need to hit the target that we're shooting at before they're shooting at us. So that's a big thing. But so that's a big one. And then we've also seen the 6mm Max come up. Brian Cook at BC Precision, he developed that based in 2019, started that around the same time Hornady started. But of course, Hornady is massive and they can move at light speed. But yeah, the other one is a 6mm Max. And it is a 350 Legend case that's been necked down to a 6mm. So it's a much longer case body. It's better on feeding and, you know, natural, like just through like regular 5.56 chamber feed ramps. And you can use a regular 5.56 bolt. So those are the benefits of that. But outside of that, they're a very well matched round. Me being a precision guy, I still lean towards the 6 arc just because of the lower standard deviation, because of the case geometry. But that's really, like, comparatively, it's peanuts. It really comes down to which cartridge is going to be more available and whether the DoD thinks that having, you know, a sole manufacturer of the 6 arc in a giant company versus a bunch of small companies building cartridges for the 6 Max is going to be better for security. I kind of flip back and forth on that, but yeah, those are the two main ones. And, you know, I think either of them is a good choice versus what we've had for the last, you know, 50, 60 years.
Yeah, for sure. Can I ask about your recent trip to the EU?
Yeah.
Cool. What were you doing?
Yeah, that was a good one, man. Yeah, so I went Enforce TAC, is obviously they do a show at the same time as EWA in Germany. So we went to Nuremberg. So I went with Noveski, small team from Nevesky, and we went and had a ton of great meetings, mostly with the end user groups. Like that's kind of still, it's the core of what Nevesky does. That's where our R&D really comes from. So you may see a website full of like guns with funny names on them. But the genesis of most of those systems was from like a very real contract for us to build something out for a specific end use, and a subset of the special operations community. So that's where we're always looking. And so going and working and meeting with a lot of those units and discussing this stuff and hearing that, you know, of course they're facing the exact same problems as us. So a big effort is going on right now where we're looking to bring systems like that 6ARC, which is not available really in the EU, trying to bring that system forward so that you know, other countries, other softs can start getting the benefit from that sooner than later, right?
Yeah.
So we did that. That was one part of it. And then the other part was for my Defense Horizon program. I'm scouting out some interesting areas, good training partners for the units if we want to run real mission training profile events. There's some really cool, really
fantastic there in Slovenia, and that was,
I think we all had a really good experience there. We got to go see their training sites, got to talk to a lot of the military guys and stuff from different countries and really dig in, and because their gun laws are a little more lax in Slovenia versus, you know, Germany and some of the other countries in the EU. It's a really good area for us to kind of like go and sort of root a little bit and kind of plan our feet in and say like, okay, this is something where we could establish a stronghold, for lack of a better term, but to come in and say, hey, we can run a lot of training here. We've got access to a lot of terrain, and a lot of good like associations with other military units that we should be training with and against in, you know, force on force type environments.
So is there a lot of collaborative sort of work going on with these other units internationally between the US and them?
I'm sorry, repeat that question again.
Is there a lot of collaborative sort of work going on between units in the US and the EU?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think that's, you know, 10th Group Special Forces is that's their area of responsibility in Europe. And so, you know, I work with those guys a lot and they're doing a great job. They've got, you know, that was part of why I was over there, was to support the this year's Trojan Footprint.
Yep.
Is happening in Poland. And so, yeah, it's constant. And they're always looking to make new relationships. They've got a really good group of folks and leaders who are taking the threats very seriously. They're doing everything they can to learn from the frontline conflicts and then to work collaboratively with these other units and at a pace that we really haven't seen. And it shows the severity of the problem, right? Like that's a big thing right now, is that I think in the past people were very like close hold with their capabilities and their equipment, you know, the tactics that they were using to succeed. And now we're seeing, it's like, okay, we're fighting something it's almost beyond nation states at this point. Like the progress of technology is like, okay, well, the ground guys, the infantrymen on the Russian side, probably also don't want to be fighting these technologies.
Yeah.
So like overall, it's just better to have that, because you know, like that's becoming the threat far faster than these like nation state activities are.
I want to ask you, just because you're the first person since it's been announced that has come on that might know anything about it or might be able to speak to an opinion on it, what is your thoughts on the soft dudes that are now being permanently deployed to Taiwan?
So that's an interesting one. Taiwan's been I have a hard time with it, just because, again, like I'm not for putting people in a precarious situation. However, Taiwan's a little different. I think China is just a different state actor
Yep.
than talking about Russia, right? like they behave very differently. China is very protective of its own long-term interests, which means it's far less likely that they would involve themselves in any like direct kinetic activity. I think that a lot of what they do is posturing, you know, but we can't just run with that assumption, right? Because that's it's an extremely dangerous assumption, and the gamble is the lives of the people we're putting out there. So I never want to support saying like, okay, well, we should be propping our folks to go posture against, like, okay, how many guys are we sending out there, right? Like, if we've got, even if we had a brigade of people there, like, we're talking about the nation of China, we're talking about the CCP, this is a huge thing. So like, what posturing could we possibly be doing? If nothing else, it seems like we may be just poking the dog a little bit. But if we are like truly intent on saying like, hey, this has to be a bastion of anti-communist values in this small area, then okay, if we're going to stand by that, then we have to provide the support, the training, and the defense infrastructure to actually stand to that. I think it's far more likely that any kinetic action that takes place with or against the Chinese state is going to happen in the Burmese Beltway, Myanmar, Laos, like those places. They hold the manufacturing footprint for all of China.
Yeah.
And absolutely vital. And so like China's been doing this, I think, since 2014 or something. We went over and basically what was happening was the Chinese military was taking entire like army units and transitioning them to private security companies. And like literally you go to these companies and they have barracks, they sleep there, they train all day, they get in formation and do PT in the morning, and like that's it. And it's like, but there, it's a private company.
Yep.
And their job is to go and secure the manufacturing and like refinery assets of China in, you know, in Africa, and then especially in that Burmese Beltway region. And so they take that very seriously. I think that it's highly likely that we'll start seeing more like proxy activity there.
Right. Okay. Now, going on from that, what do you think? This is just two dudes gas bagging, so feel free to say whatever you feel like. What do you think is the next 5 years going to look like in terms of conflict? And because everyone thinks World War III is going to happen tomorrow, what do you think is kind of like the sequence of events for the next 5-10 years?
Man, that's a tough one. I think that there's going to be more. I think that we're going to see more more probing reconnaissance from the Western Allied forces, I believe. As this conflict continues and matures, and as we get a better grasp of the technologies and start actually like utilizing technologies that are a level above these FPV drones, these, you know, homemade warfinding systems, et cetera. And I think we are on the cusp of that. I've had some very interesting conversations in the last couple of months with leadership from the Air Command and places that are above soldier systems technologies, as far as like how that can be supported. But I think as far as the ground concern goes for the guys, I think that it's going to be more of the same. And I think that the highest performing units are going to start getting really good taskers as far as, doing what I could only equate to like ghost reconnaissance type stuff, like from the games, like having to run pro Balkans and things like that. I think that's definitely going to be likely. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I don't see the war effort really taking a huge step one way or the other. I just see the like our effort, especially within the EU countries, becoming more organized. and starting to envelop and start to adopt more of the Gen 5 warfare stuff, which is all information based. And that's where it needs to go. It just takes a lot of infrastructure to actually manage and execute that successfully.
Through your work currently, what sort of trends are you seeing in warfare in terms of where it's heading? I know you said before, like, it seems like it's kind of going back in history with obviously the technology side of things increasing, people are trying to rely on more the analog side of things to, I guess, to protect themselves and to work around different problem sets. What sort of trends are you mainly seeing, like, through Ukraine and that sort of thing?
I think the trajectory is pretty, pretty clear that it's going to be way more enabled small units that are going to be supported by AI sensing systems, probably operating. And then this is going to be something that, like, of course, the signature reduction stuff, us going back to the old school analog version of everything, is a protective posture that we have to take right now, because we don't have the countermeasures or the overarching like security to emplace into these new conflict environments. Like in Iraq, like, what do we have there? Like, we own the sky, we own everything, and we were able to manage that, but here we don't have that available to us. So it's a different type of thing. So it's going to be far more network supported, like data assets, passive management integration of AI systems to help derive where threat areas are most likely based off of certain things. And that, even like, probably the next biggest, I'm probably not going to mention this. I think there are going to be some technological leaps within the next few years. That will change the way we're able to manage, interact, and avoid, avoid risk, and to still accomplish our mission, whatever that is. So a better way for us to be able to put our kinetic assets in use, and making sure that we can return to that low risk operation environment. I would say relatively low risk, but where we actually have control and have a good ability to sense what is happening in one environment over another.
Is AI playing like a direct, I mean, I can probably think about what I would assume is happening, but is AI playing an active role in the technological advancements in terms of AI, in terms of warfare, sorry?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's becoming now, right? Like, so a good instance would be like these war finding systems, right? Where basically you're able to download an app onto a phone, link that phone to a sensing system, and then strap that entire device to a drone and launch it on a pre-designated search grid. And it will automatically populate signal and of any sort. And it will actually designate what type of signal it is and exactly where it is onto everyone else's end user device, right? And like, that's technology that is being thrown together and utilized by not our forces and not, like, you know, US aligned forces, but by Russian forces and anybody who can put it together. People are doing it all the time. So with that, and then integrating AI software to be able to provide a higher level of certainty, just based off of the whole of data that those systems are able to gather. Like, that's going to be a big thing. It's going to come to threat sensing systems is going to be a big one. As far as the AI backend network for integrating other reconnaissance drones to help support end users on the ground, That's another big one. The company Anduril has been working very diligently on that for years. They basically created a very strong AI backend network, and then they are absorbing companies and technologies that they can then build into that AI interface. And it's pretty cool. If you look at some of the stuff they've built, even if it's not, you know, deployment ready, I've seen some really interesting demos from that stuff, and they seem to be really far out ahead because they're taking those big jumps, a lot like SpaceX or something like that. Like, they're taking big leaps, and technology risks, but they seem to have something that actually works. There's some merit to saying, hey, if I can punch out eight dudes and we can run UAS or loitering reconnaissance systems that would be able to sense biological presence, heat presence, signal presence, and then immediately provide that information to the ground troop, then it's very difficult to hide from something like that, especially a swarm of drones that are not working as one. They're problem solving independently, and they're being supercharged by this AI backend information analysis network. So that's something that we're seeing happen like very quickly. And I think that we're going to see that integrated into certain units sooner rather than later.
I'm going to break this down as simple as possible. So are you saying that we're moving to a point pretty much of a UAV from Call of Duty, where you send it up and it fucking picks up biological traits, whether it be heat or movement or whatever it might be, and it can send that straight to ground forces, ATAC or phone or tablet, whatever the fuck they're using, and they have a instant analysis of, this is our, say, grid square that we're looking at. This is where the bad guys are.
Yeah, or most likely for them to be, right? Because that's the AI side too, is like, it will look where, okay, I can see what infillate and deflate is, and I don't see hot bodies here. So if we've got dead space, then it's going to assign a higher risk probability to those deflate areas, to areas of top cover. And then also tie in the information of, okay, how close is this building to a major roadway? What are the access lines look like? Have there been significant actions in this area previously? Like, those things are going to populate and calculate, autonomously. And then that is what's going to derive it. And so we're not designating and engaging targets based off that information. What we're doing is avoiding contact. Off that information, right? Like, I think hopefully we maintain this aspect of, like, this is a life-saving technology versus a technology that we can just allow to win the war for us, or lose the war if we're hitting the wrong target. So that's I think that's where it kind of has to go. Like, we're not going backwards unless we go all the way backwards, right? I can't imagine where we're not going to be utilizing UAS or these systems. And it really comes down to, like, right now is, like, how do we make it so that we don't have such a large signal presence as a fighting force? And that technology it's a little more involved than people, it's like, we're getting into some deep science stuff there, but, like, it's coming. And of course, war is, like, when people get scared, they get shot into overtime or overdrive with their technological development and the amount of time they're spending. When they know that there's a big contract on the horizon, if they can just solve the problem of, passive range finding, right? How do I not shoot a laser to know how far something is and have get a really good feedback on that? I've seen companies go all sorts of directions on problem solving that, like, very interesting stuff. It really just comes down to which one is going to work in the most environments consistently, and provide that end user feedback, and then allow that end user feedback to be disseminated to the entire fighting force with a corrective adjustment based off of their actual position, and at the lowest signature possible.
That is the potential for that sort of technology is absolutely fucking terrifying, but it's also incredible that that's where we're at currently.
Yeah, it's scary, man. And that's one of the things that like I spend a lot of time on is, you know, when we see these technologies arrive, it's like, okay, marching in a straight line is going to take us to into EMP territory, right? So like pulse weapons, non-nuclear EMPs. These are things that it's, I think it's well established that those systems have been tested, and we're probably on multiple generations of that at this point. But if we stay on this direct trajectory line, okay, the Kremlin's been hit by multiple FPV drones, right? How many of those does it take before they initiate a defensive system and a posture to just shut down all, you know, all electronic tech in a space to protect themselves while they buffer the inside of the Kremlin with, you know, with put themselves in basically a Faraday cage, right? And then from there, what's the next step? Okay, well, how do we put this onto a deployable package that we can run on a truck so that if we start taking a drone assault, then we just hit the big red button and shut the sky down?
Yeah.
And then we looking the next step after that is EMP predicated assaults, right? So like, okay, if we're going to go assault a place, we're going to shut everything down, and then we're going to be fighting cave people again with all of our fun technology. And that's not a place we want it to go, because there's like, like that's a major thing. Like it's not a nuke. But the like destruction of critical infrastructure and technology, tech infrastructure, those are the systems that keep people alive, that keep people communicating. And a lot of that stuff can't be worked back. So it's either going to be we're either going to have to create enough defensive measures against electromagnetic pulse weapons to where they no longer are a viable option, or there needs to be some type of an agreement that like, okay, this is obviously not where we need to take this. We're trying to, hopefully both sides are looking to save lives and not take lives. But sometimes I feel like those thoughts get conflated and all of that. And yeah, so it's a big point of concern for me, but that's, you know, that's why I take so much interest in like working with these units and working with the companies too, to say like, okay, what is the end state here? What are you aiming for? Are we just aiming to save a certain subset of a population of soldiers and like in doing so, are we causing more harm to the overall humanity value? And that's something I think we have to stay like really cognizant of as we keep marching towards this with fear in mind.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so moving to something a little bit happier, I guess, or a little bit more exciting. You've got a competition coming up, is it?
Yeah, so the USASOC Sniper competition is kicking off pretty soon. And so, we've been lucky. I've been working with a unit over the last few months and doing a lot of like really recce heavy capabilities development. We're working on some new cool things, but yeah, they got a couple of stud shooters that are going to go and compete. So we're going to support them, and they'll be fielding some new tech. Yep. Pretty excited for those pictures to hit the wire. Some stuff that you know, I've been working really hard on behind the scenes with companies, trying to build out, because the output values on these systems, gun systems, and you know, and new lighter weight, you know, technology systems are just, they're really killer. So I'm pumped to see those pictures get leaked out, and the DoD posts it. But yeah, so I'm excited. I think they're coming here right now. Actually, I'm over at my big shooting spot, so we're gonna go try and see if we can't call in some coyotes and then ring some steel here in a little bit.
How long does that competition go for?
It's basically a work week.
Yep.
So they just run it through. Now it's not all constant. There's night, daylight and night range, or lanes they go through. And it's a lot of, they try and put in a lot of scenario based stuff for this. I'm excited to see, just based off of how the Nasty was, which is the one that they run at Hat Creek. Brian Morgan runs it at Hat Creek in Idaho. to me, that's become like the bastion, like the leader in any of these sniper team competitions, because they just do such a good job of integrating like current threat problems and ensuring that the end users are able to utilize and optimize their kit to mimic those environments. So like a good example of that is a lot of competitions you'd go to, especially for night competitions, they'll run, guys will be running I2 night vision clip-ons because the steel targets don't hold thermal past sundown very long, right? And so you can't see them on thermal. But if we were actually like engaged in conflict, like, okay, the thermal 100% crushes the I2 systems, because the I2 system, for two reasons. I2 system, number one, they're so reliant on ambient light that you kind of can't get around using a NIR floodlight or something like that, or an NIR spotlight, which is obviously a signature that we cannot expose now in battle. So it's just unrealistic. And the second thing is like, yeah, thermal profile is you don't have to be moving. Like if I'm running an I2 system, I kind of need to see that before I'm like, oh, that's a target, right? Versus thermal was like, okay, I'm seeing thermal loading, I see a hot spot there, like we can keep an eye on that. That's something that we want guys to be able to utilize the tech that they will actually be utilizing in a conflict situation. And I think the USASOC sniper competition, I'm hopeful that they are going to integrate more of that, that they'll thermal load the targets at night, so that they can actually utilize the systems that they would utilize in combat.
Yeah, okay. Just closing up, Mac, do you have anything that you kind of want to not reveal, but I guess talk about that you're kind of working on at the moment, or anything that people listening can kind of get involved with or whatever it might be?
Yeah, absolutely. Number one, my Defense Horizon program. You can find us online. We've got an email address on our website at defensehorizon.org. If anybody wants to help jump in on problem solving, we love volunteers for this, right? It's a nonprofit. So a lot of guys that get out and they find themselves working in the industry or around the industry or still have friends that are in, like we get a lot of value from them coming on and sharing their experiences and learning along with us and going to these things. When we run training events, I have it set up so that innovations people from the vendor companies can come out and actually run training and learn themselves exactly what the problem sets are, so they can come back and educate their product development pipeline. So that's a really big one. It just takes, we want interaction. We've been working with great companies. We've been supported for the last year from a number of awesome companies, who jumped on board immediately because they saw the value in being able to engage directly with the end users and not through this like bloated contract command authority, to solve those problems. And we can get contracts through real fast. We say warp speed is kind of our little motto tagline. Been in DOD, like we are genuinely moving, we are moving at C.99, like we're going fast, to get all of this stuff to
all right, ladies and gents, just wait a second, he's dropped out, he's on a property, so see if he comes back. I'm gonna pause it right here so you don't have to wait for silence. Alrighty, ladies and gents, welcome back. Mac is back on. His phone died. We deal with this shit and we move on. So what were we talking about? We were talking about your endeavor and anything else that you kind of want people to know about so they can get involved.
Yeah, so DefenseHorizon.org. You can go there. Little information on there, but if you reach out to us, we'll bring you up to speed. If companies are looking to jump in the cycle and get some guys out to train with the units, educate their R&D pipeline, then we welcome that. That's huge for us. We've got some events coming up. We'll be running a Touchpoint event the weekend before Soft Week, so that'll be May 4th and 5th. We'll be running a small hog hunt deal, and then we'll be doing the Touchpoint event at the Team Room in Sarasota.
the afternoon of the 5th. So we're looking forward to a good time with that. If anybody wants to come out, just reach out and we'll give you the details. Outside of that, I will say for the Noveski side, we've got some cool stuff coming with the 6 arc, some program guns that we've been working pretty hard on, some full system suppressor stuff. Definitely pay attention to that. We got some really interesting platforms coming out soon. And then, and outside of that, we're starting to dig into some pretty cool new age tech to start pushing gun systems to the limit. So I'm really excited to be a part of that whole working group there too.
Cool. Anyone listening to this, where can they find you and your endeavors on social media? Because everything works through social media nowadays.
Yeah. So I'm at King Mackerel on Instagram. I've got a Twitter. I don't do much on it. Instagram is probably the best place to find me and keep up with what's going on.
Cool.
I'll put out details and stuff on my stories. And then I have an account for Defense Horizon. We don't put a lot on there just because we're working with the end user group. Sometimes we'll get some cool stuff that we can put on there, but we're being very choosy about how we're managing that info.
Yep.
But that's at King Mackerel. Hit me up.
Cool.
Hope everybody gets something from what I'm putting out.
Awesome. Thanks again, bro, for coming on in the hour that you had spare time. So I appreciate it. And we'll keep in touch and maybe get you on in the future again to talk about what else is going on.
Definitely, man. I appreciate it. This has been awesome. All right. Well, we can shoot. It sounds like.
Thanks, bro. Go have a shoot. And thank you again.
All right. Have a good one, man.
You too, bro.